Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
BBC, BBC.
This is Science in Action from the BBC World Service. I'm John Stewart. In the programme this week, mind reading.
We're talking about longer periods than 10 seconds ahead of a decision that we can predict how someone is going to make up their mind.
Shocking, but true. Details coming up. Plus, a space mission that could answer some of our most fundamental questions about our planet.
GOGE is a very amazing mission. Since Isaac Newton, we know that there is a gravity field, and this mission is looking into the details of gravity field.
And amazing substances that can soak up and store gases.
For 1 gram of these crystals, you could hold surface area that would cover 40 tennis courts.
We'll find out if they're the answer to our planet's CO2 problem. First up, flu epidemics are thought to infect up to 15% of the world's population each year. They cause up to 5 million cases of severe illness and up to 500,000 deaths, according to figures from the World Health Organization. But better flu vaccines could be on the horizon, thanks to work just published in the journal Science. There have been many theories for how seasonal flu viruses travel around the world, but essentially the global movement patterns for these viruses have remained a mystery for about 60 years. Now researchers have figured out where the most common type of the virus comes from and how it spreads around the planet. Colin Russell and Derek Smith from the Department of Zoology at the University of Cambridge in the UK, in collaboration with the WHO Global Influenza Surveillance Network, have been tracking the flu bug.
We analyzed about 13,000 influenza A, H3N2 viruses.
That's just one particular strain of influenza, is it?
Yes, that's correct. It's the subtype of influenza that causes the most disease.
So an important one to be looking at.
Yes, it is.
And you were analyzing these samples?
Yes, we analyzed these samples, and we were able to trace the movements of the viruses around the world. And what we saw is that viruses in Europe and in North America and South America and Australia and New Zealand, they all came from a common source, and that common source was East and Southeast Asia.
Now, have you been able to actually tease out the pattern of how they move from East and Southeast Asia around the rest of the globe?
Well, we have actually. So one of the things we find is we find this global hierarchy of how influenza viruses move. So influenza viruses originate in East and Southeast Asia, and then they move to places that are well connected to East and Southeast Asia via travel. And this is primarily via air travel. And so we see influenza viruses first moving from East and Southeast Asia to places like Europe and North America and Australia and New Zealand. And then later they move to South America. And they probably move to South America last because South America is relatively isolated in terms of global air travel away from East and Southeast Asia.
Derek Smith, flu vaccines are produced every year, and the difficulty has always been to discover which strains to vaccinate against. Does this work help in that?
Yes, it does. Indeed, many of our co-authors are involved in the vaccine strain selection process. And this work is, on one hand, it's a piece of basic science, and it's an evolutionary study. And on the other hand, it's absolutely a study about the continual improvement of the influenza virus vaccine.
Why is it so difficult, or why has it been so difficult, to select the strains to vaccinate against?
Well, influenza virus evolves quickly and in complex ways, and it's also a virus that spreads throughout the world. And, well, it's a complicated system.
And I guess it's trying to decide in advance as well, isn't it?
That's exactly right. So we have this situation where, for the Northern Hemisphere, there are about 300 million people who are vaccinated each year. And in order to have time to produce that vaccine and distribute it and have people be vaccinated and build up immunity, we have to make the vaccine choice about 1 year in advance of when the next flu season is going to happen.
And making that choice, making that selection is difficult if you don't know the pattern, if you don't know how the virus is actually spreading around the world.
That's exactly right. We have this complicated system and this evolutionary system where the virus continues to evolve. And we have to predict what happens a year in advance.
if we have a better idea of where the virus is coming from, which we perhaps do with this new study, this East and Southeast Asia region, does that mean that increased surveillance there would be useful?
Yes, it absolutely does. There are already really excellent collaborations and surveillance throughout East and Southeast Asia, and there have been over many years, which is the substance of the data that are used not only for vaccine strain selection, but also for this research that's aimed at improving vaccine strain selection. Just like any system, it can be improved, and certainly this gives very good reason to be able to really try to answer specific questions in the region, and actually specific questions as well about what is driving the evolution in the region. Because the ultimate goal of what we're trying to do here is to increase our ability to predict the evolution of influenza viruses for vaccine strain selection purposes. And, you know, if we can figure out what the evolutionary pressures are, then that gives us the opportunity to be able to get a step ahead of the virus. So all regions, including East and Southeast Asia, will have a heads up of where the virus might go next. And of course, the attendant benefits for vaccine strain selection.
Colin Russell and Derek Smith from the University of Cambridge in the UK. Next, researchers have been able to pick up signals in our brains that show a choice that we're going to make. And they've been able to do that a full 10 seconds before we'd be consciously aware that we're going to make that decision. Professor John Dylan Haynes put subjects in a scanner, which allowed him to monitor which parts of the brain were active at any given time. The findings sound incredible, a point I put to him.
Most interesting decisions that we make in everyday life are decisions of the type where you can freely pace when you want to make your decision and you can freely choose which outcome this is going to have. For example, if I have to decide which city to move to or if I have to decide for buying one car or another car, these are decisions I don't have to reflexively, spontaneously perform, but I can take my time. And in these cases, something that brain science hasn't really looked into very much, in these cases, it's not that surprising, in my view, that the brain takes a while to prepare a decision, much longer than just a few milliseconds.
So it's something we ponder away on in that expression in the back of our minds.
Absolutely. Specifically, what we wanted to know in this study was, what is the relationship between our consciousness, between the feeling that we have at some point in time, now I want this, and it's just kind of emerged in my mind that now I want, for example, in our case, to press the left or right button, and the preparation in the brain that is unconscious that precedes the decision that we make. Because, of course, this is a very interesting question because it relates to the idea, who is the author of our decisions? Is it us or is it our brain activity?
Well, talk us through exactly what you did have these subjects doing in order to look into this in a bit more detail.
So in brain science, when we investigate decisions, we have to use toy scenarios for decision making. So we ask people to decide simply between two possible button presses. So a subject is lying in a scanner and we give them one button in their left hand and another button in their right hand. And they're free at some point of their own liking to make a decision to either press the left or the right button. Now, this decision, we can then look back from this point in time when they make up their mind, can try and predict from brain activity how someone is going to decide in the future, say 2 seconds in the future, 4 seconds in the future, and so on. And what we find there is that the earliest prediction that we can perform from brain signals is about 7 to 8 seconds before someone makes up their mind. And because the signals that we record, the technology that we have is a little bit sluggish, it's a bit slow, it takes 3 or 4 seconds for this signal to build up, you can actually say that you have to predict that even further. So we're talking about, say, longer periods than 10 seconds ahead of a decision that we can predict how someone is going to make up their mind.
So just to be clear, because you had these subjects in a brain scanner while they were making a decision, you were able to look at which part of their brains were active at any given point and work out from that whether they were about to make a decision.
Absolutely. So what we do is we record their brain activity during the whole sequence leading up to their decision, and then we try and work our way back and try and predict from the brain activity how someone is going to decide in the future.
Now, previous studies have shown a time lag of just a few milliseconds in between this kind of decision-making process, but to take that up to 10 seconds is really opens a whole load of questions. I've been reading a lot of comments online about your work this week. People saying things like, oh, are we actually living behind the present then?
Well, that's a very interesting question. In my view, the consciousness lags behind the processes that enable our consciousness. So this has been something that's been described in brain science a number of times. Take a different case. Say, for example, if you're doing mountaineering and you're climbing, you might find yourself in a situation where you slip and then your foot slips away and then you reflexively make the correct movement. It seems that you do this unconsciously because this is so rapid, and then your consciousness kicks in later. And this point, when your consciousness kicks in, you might even be startled or afraid about the automaticity of your response. I think what this shows is that our brain is processing all the time in the background, helping us out, doing all sorts of routine work for us, even in emergency situations, and that the consciousness comes later.
So there's some sort of filter in between our unconscious and our conscious side. I guess it would just be overwhelming to have all that information and be consciously aware of it all.
Absolutely. Just think about a situation where you might be sitting on a chair. Do you really exactly think about all the muscles that you use to control your posture? No. You just think, I'm going to go and sit down on this chair, and your brain does all the rest for you. It's actually quite convenient what the brain does for us, because the brain takes care of all this detailed chores that we have in our everyday processes. You don't want to be thinking about how you're exactly using your muscles when you're sitting down on a chair. You want to be thinking about sitting down on a chair and giving an interview. Yeah.
Except now that you've mentioned it, I'm acutely conscious of the way I'm sitting in this chair. I just have to adjust. What's next for you in this work? Where are you going to take it?
Of course, of major interest is the implication that our work has for free will, because what our data show is that by the point in time when you feel that you're making the decision has already largely been made by the brain. So we're interested in questions like, if this brain signal starts to make a decision, can we still consciously act against the decision that the brain has made? I think this is very important, because this will show if there is an automatic necessity for you to do a specific action after your brain has decided, or if there's still some kind of way in which your conscious mind can enter the process.
That's Professor John Dylan Haynes at the Charité University Hospital and the Bernstein Center for Computational Neuroscience in Berlin, Germany. This is Science in Action from the BBC World Service. I'm John Stewart. A European space mission is preparing to investigate some of the mysteries of our planet. For example, did you know that you weigh less at the equator than you do at the North Pole? It's due to the fact that the force of gravity you experience standing on the Earth varies slightly from place to place. The GOCE, or Gravity Field and Steady State Ocean Circulation Explorer mission, should give scientists a more detailed map of the Earth's gravity field, and that will help improve our understanding of the Earth's interior and the physics associated with things like earthquakes and volcanoes. It could also improve measurements of ocean circulation, sea level change, and even ice sheet movements, all of which are affected by climate change. Helen Briggs visited the spacecraft at the European Space Agency's research base ESTEC in the Netherlands, where it's being prepared for launch.
We are here now in the clean room where the satellite GOCE is at the moment, and we have a view of the full satellite in its full glory.
Project manager Danilo Musi surveys the GOCE spacecraft, soon to depart on a mission to investigate the Earth's gravity field. Unusually, it has wings and looks a little like a spy plane.
It's a very unusual shape. It's quite sleek. It's quite dart-like.
Yes, this is because we had to design the satellite in order to cope with the air drag that it will face, the orbit altitude that it will fly. So it has an aerodynamic shape, a bit like a space plane.
Mention gravity, and you might picture Sir Isaac Newton watching the iconic apple falling from a tree. It was once thought gravity was constant, wherever you were on the Earth. We now know this could only hold true if the planet were a perfect sphere with a completely smooth surface. Because the Earth's surface is lumpy and the centrifugal force as it spins makes it bulge a little in the middle, there are slight variations in the force of gravity from place to place, as Volker Liebig, Director of Earth Observation Programs at ESA, explains.
GOJE is a very amazing mission since Isaac Newton. We know that there is a gravity field, and this mission is looking into the details of gravity field, because the famous apple of Newton falling off the tree is not falling on each point of the planet equal. So we look into what are the differences.
GOJE will map these tiny variations using an instrument known as a gradiometer. This contains six accelerometers arranged in the centre of a specially engineered cage, as ESA's Mark Drinkwater explains.
Each one of them has a mass inside. It's a piece of platinum rhodium, which responds to the Earth's gravitational pull and small variations in that pull as the satellite flies along.
The accelerometers are arranged in pairs in three dimensions. Each pair will experience the gravitational tug of the Earth slightly differently, picking up accelerations that are less than 1/1,000,000 of the G-force we experience when standing on the Earth. Dr. Mark Drinkwater again.
This is in contrast to previous gravity missions, which have measured a single value of the acceleration caused by Earth's gravity as the satellite flies along. And so what we end up with is like a, as opposed to a black and white or monochrome picture of the Earth's gravity field, what we're talking about here is a real vivid colour picture describing very small variability in the Earth's gravity field.
The test masses inside the accelerometers must be kept in free fall all the time to produce reliable readings. GOJE uses a propulsion system that throttles a special engine up and down to, in effect, fly the spacecraft around the test masses. The engine is powered by positively charged particles, or ions.
Well, my name is Neil Wallace, and I'm the technical lead of the EP team, the electric propulsion team here at Kinetic in Farnborough. These type of engines will only run in a vacuum. To test them on the ground, we have to reproduce the conditions in space. So we have some relatively large metal chambers where you evacuate the chamber down to very low pressures, normally 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 millibar, so 1/1,000,000 of an atmosphere.
Ion engines work by using an electric field to accelerate a beam of ions away from the spacecraft, thereby providing propulsion. They're very efficient, making missions lighter and cheaper to launch. Crucially for GOJE, they also provide cruise control, as Neil Wallace explains.
This spacecraft is hurtling through the atmosphere at a speed of about 8.5 kilometres a second. And as it travels around the Earth, it's going through the upper atmosphere, and it experiences a buffeting. And they need to compensate that buffeting very, very accurately. And that's what we're doing. So we're actually providing cruise control for this spacecraft.
GOJE will be launched this summer from the Russian spaceport of Plesetsk. It will go up on the same type of rocket that failed 3 years ago, destroying Europe's Cryosat ice mission. Neil Wallace says the nature of the space business makes watching any launch a dramatic event.
You spend 10 years working on a mission, treating the components and equipment like a newborn baby. You never take it out of a clean room. And then you stick it on top of 100 tons of high explosive and set light to it. So it's always an exciting time, that. But no, the most exciting time for us will be when that spacecraft comes over the horizon and the ground station picks it up, and you can see that the engines are doing what we've always said they will do.
A slightly nervous sounding Neil Wallace ending that report by Helen Briggs. Surges in hormones could be responsible for boom and bust economics. Sounds unlikely? Here's our fact file.
Changing levels of the male hormone testosterone in stock market traders has been directly linked to the profits they make.
Researchers from the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom also found that the level of the stress hormone cortisol could affect the risks they take on the trading floor.
It may help to explain investment bankers' seemingly irrational behaviour.
The researchers measured the levels of both hormones in the blood of a small group of male City of London traders and match them to the levels of profit or loss recorded for that day.
Stock market traders effectively gamble on the stock market with their clients' money.
When they win or make a profit, the levels of testosterone in their blood increases.
However, if repeated too much, the rising testosterone levels could eventually compromise their ability to make rational decisions, as the traders take bigger and bigger risks during so-called bubbles where the market rises sharply.
The other hormone, cortisol, is produced in response to stress and, in the case of traders, extreme volatility in the markets.
High cortisol levels cause the opposite effect of testosterone and make the traders much more cautious and less likely to take risks and less likely to make huge profits.
The researchers think the stock market will be much less volatile if more women were employed, as the hormones don't have the same pronounced effects in females.
Materials that could help soak up and capture CO2 from power station or vehicle exhausts have been developed by researchers in the United States. They're making what are effectively micro sponges, which can trap many times their own volume of gas. As well as capturing pollutants, they could be used to store fuel, hydrogen for powering cars, for example. To find out more about exactly what these metal sponges are and how they're made, I went to visit Professor Omar Yaghi at the University of California, Los Angeles.
Let's say for 1 gram of these crystals, you could hold surface area that would cover 40 tennis courts. For example, if I was using these crystals to store hydrogen or to capture carbon dioxide from a power plant smokestack, these materials could hold the equivalent of about 40 tennis courts for each gram.
Sounds like quite a phenomenal number. What are they actually made of? Are they quite simple chemically, or are they very complicated structures?
We call them metal organic frameworks, or for short, MOFs. So a typical MOF structure is composed of the main component of, let's say, plastic bottles, and the inorganic components are zinc, things like zinc oxide, which is the main component of sunscreen. So they're very common materials, and they can be mixed together to make beautiful crystals.
And it's because they are crystals and therefore have sort of voids in them that they're able to trap and effectively store gases. Is that right?
Yeah, the way this works is that if you imagine a scaffolding of struts and intersections, and now you compress this all the way into a very small crystal, and then you have lots of these crystals, then you can imagine that these voids are of the size of gas molecules like carbon dioxide and hydrogen, which are very important to trap and capture. And the way it works is that these materials, we design them in such a way that they are attractive to the gas molecules, and they stack the gas molecules like you would stack cars in a car park.
To see exactly how these crystals are made, we're in the lab with Professor Yaghi and also Bo Wang, who's responsible for actually making a lot of them. This looks like a typical chemistry lab, a very cluttered bench full of vials and bottles and all sorts of reagents, a lot going on in here. Is this where you would actually start constructing these crystals?
Yes, this typical reaction setup. We premix the metal and organic linkers in those vials and heat them in those ovens with different temperature, different time period. Eventually, we get really nice, beautiful crystals.
So you literally just pour two different things together into a glass vial, heat them up, and hope something happens. Can we look inside these ovens without messing anything up?
Yeah, here's one of those isotherm oven at 85 degrees C. You can see all those reaction vessels or those macro plates and having different type of reactions happening in there. And you can see a lot of crystals or those small powders are forming at the bottom. And they're then analyzed in detail using our X-ray diffraction for their structure and using our gas separation apparatus for their performance.
So these colors that I can see in these vials, and you've got some red vials, some yellowy looking ones, some with some blue powder at the bottom. Professor Yaghi, these are your crystals forming at the bottom here, are they?
Depending on what kind of metal you have in the structure, you have a different color. And I want to point out here, we have about 96 reactions going on right now, and you can see already that some of the crystals are already forming in some of these wells. This allows us to discover new structures at a much faster rate than has been possible in previous times.
But this is literally how you do it. You'll just mix different amounts, and each one of those wells contains a slightly different amount of the reagents you're using, and just keep testing and testing until you find good ones.
Yes, in fact, this is not unlike what you do sometimes in the kitchen. Okay, mixing two things together and then worrying about what kind of product you want.
Have a little taste, see if it's working, add a little bit more.
Perhaps not taste. I don't encourage my students to taste, but sometimes smell, although that's not encouraged either. But anyway, we have then sophisticated instrumentation that then look inside each one of these wells and determine whether crystals have formed in the way we would like them to form and also to determine the blueprint of how the atoms are connected in the crystal, which is something you can't do in your own kitchen.
And as Professor Omar Yagi went on to explain, these materials could have a lot of potential applications.
Well, there are thousands of possible structures, and therefore thousands of possible applications. Energy applications figure prominently here because of the urgent need to find renewable sources of energy.
So how could crystals like this help?
Well, in the case of hydrogen storage, to fuel a typical automobile so that you have a driving range of about 400 kilometers, you need about 5 kilograms of hydrogen. 5 kilograms of hydrogen at room temperature would fill a container that is about 5 meters in diameter. And certainly none of us would like to have that as our fuel tank driving through Los Angeles or other cities. So the idea is that could we take this gas that would fill this large volume and compact it in the pores of these crystals? And so far, we've succeeded in doing this for methane and carbon dioxide, and we've made tremendous progress in storing hydrogen as well. But we have not reached the full maturity of the hydrogen storage issue.
But potentially one day you could have a fuel tank in your car that's full of crystals rather than just an empty tank.
Yeah.
And it would be the crystals that hold the hydrogen in a much more compact way than having it just as a loose gas.
That's certainly the vision, and it's being realized for storing methane or natural gas, and it's being realized for carbon dioxide. But for hydrogen, the vision is that, yes, that these crystals would be your nano fuel tank, so to speak.
That was Professor Omar Yagi and also Bo Wang speaking to me at the University of California, Los Angeles. Next week on the program, for the first time in tens of thousands of years, hear Neanderthals speaking. Science in Action this week was produced by Fiona Roberts. I'm John Stewart. There's more on all today's stories, and you can sign up for our podcast, full details at bbcworldservice.com.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.